Restaurant Unstoppable, episode 1068 with Kate Halicek.
No, it's like, I feel like we touched on all the topics. Like, as much as I love talking about my career, my passion for food, I definitely love talking about advocacy in the industry. Like, that's such a passion of mine. And I just want people to be armed with the tools to know that they can work in an environment and feel good.
Are you ready for it factors, success stories, failures, and bombs of restaurant industry knowledge? Then join Eric Cacciatore and today's incredible guest as they share what it takes to become unstoppable.
This episode is brought to you by Mies. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary IP and stay in sync, giving the culinary team the ability to both create recipes and distribute them from the same platform. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yield of ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Mies account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. This episode made possible by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, use cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way. This podcast was made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. To learn more, head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode brought to you by Owner.com. Owner.com is the leading all-in-one platform for restaurant marketing. Owner.com powers everything from SEO-optimized websites, direct online ordering, automated email and text marketing, built-in loyalty programs, zero commission delivery, and branded mobile apps for your restaurant that's integrated right into your POS. With Owner.com, there's no contract, no hidden fees, and nothing to lose. Join thousands of restaurant owners using Owner.com to grow direct online sales, save thousands in third-party fees, and simplify their online ordering presence all in one. Book a free demo today at owner.com/unstoppable and see why owner.com is the number one rated restaurant marketing software. With excitement, allow me to introduce to you today's guest, chef owner at Lionheart Confections, Kate Halicek. Kate, my lady, are you feeling unstoppable today?
I am.
Yes, I am psyched to have you here and get right up on that mic. But I'm super excited to have you. I don't think I've ever had anybody on the show who I graduated high school with.
Yeah.
So that's a first time for me. I think there's been extra grads, but I think this is the first time we actually knew each other going all the way back to high school.
We had classes together.
And it's been so much fun to like to watch you from the sidelines grow your bakery. I wouldn't call it bake your business, but you're just super talented. Like, and like, I don't think you knew you were going to do this back in the day. This kind of came out of left field for you. Because didn't you go to school for like art?
Yeah, I went to art school.
Design?
But also, like, you kind of saw the undertones when I was in high school because I used to bring cookies all the time because that was my way to get people to like me. My dad always jokes. He's like, he would walk up to, you know, he would pantomime him, of course. He'd be like, have a cookie, please like me. And I'm like, I feel like I still do that. I always bring treats for friends and whatnot. And I'm just
food
like,
is a great way to win people over.
Yeah.
It can't be it for sure. And it's just been so much fun to see your success and what you've done with Lionheart. And I cannot wait to dive into the woman you've become today. But let's get that motivational, inspirational ball rolling with a success quote and mantra. What do you got for us?
God, it's like, it's hard to put into words like what I've based a lot of my business off of. It's kind of like what, you know, Matt Berry was saying in the prior interview. It's like kind of doing, you know, lead with a kind heart, you know, always have good intentions and, you know, live unapologetically. Mm. Like I, like most people, I've like had a whole life of people pleasing and now I'm just starting to live my life as authentically as possible.
Yeah.
So.
And you're starting to develop a reputation locally. Everyone knows who you are. Everywhere I go, everyone knows Kate. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm going to head
for better or for worse.
I'm headed to New York next week and Sother Teague knows you, who I'm getting on the show. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you've been able to get your name out there in this incredible way, but you also have a ton of respect from everybody in the industry. And I think you're also kind of putting your foot down and speaking up for your values and really kind of, you kind of have a reputation for, you know, she's going to tell you what she thinks.
Yeah.
And like you stand up for people in the industry too. Is that safe to say?
Very much so. It's been an interesting journey because I lovingly tell people that I don't want this next generation of restaurant workers to have the stories that I have. You know, I know it's formed me into the person I am now, but it's like, I went through a lot of trauma in these like very much like toxic kitchens and I just don't want people to have those stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've helped a lot of people like navigate those situations. Like the number of times people have slipped in my DMs and they're just like, I have this situation with, you know, a boss and, you know, I'm like, all right, start documenting, like, you know, how can I help you feel safe?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you are the epitome of the transformation that's happening in the restaurant industry right now. So I just want to come out of the gates to recognize that. But I don't think we've had you share. Wait, we just had you share the success quote or mantra. Just hit me with it one more time.
Basically live unapologetically, always lead with a kind heart, and just have good intentions.
Awesome. And you are living that every day for sure. So
for the most part, yeah.
Great way to get this thing started. Where does it make sense to start sharing your story? Take us back to the beginning. When did you know that you wanted to be like a culinary, why is the word escaping me? Pastry chef. Jesus, yeah. I couldn't figure out why that was out of my mouth. But yeah, when did you know that was your path?
I mean, as soon as I could reach the counter, I was helping my family cook. I have a lot of amazing women in my family that, you know, that like all holidays and stuff revolved around food. So I learned how to bake from my aunt, my grandmother. She wasn't alive when I was, since I've been around my great grandmother, but I have all her cookbooks, things like that. And, you know, I realized like, you know, food brings people together, but the visceral reaction people have to dessert is so different than savory food. A lot of nostalgia. You watch people turn, like grown adults turn into children. Like when something's inside, like it's an ice cream, it's a type of cookie or like things like that. You just watch someone transform in front of you. And I could see like the visceral reaction. I always like chase that feeling. So I knew like once I start to go into like culinary, like aspirations in that field that that's what I want to focus on. I worked my way through a lot of, like corporate restaurants, like most kids, like in college, like my first college job was like Panera and I was the little bakery bitch, you know, cutting bagels and stuff, but I still liked that aspect of things. But it wasn't until I got my first non-corporate restaurant. I worked at Sierra Sparks in Bedford and I was a little pantry cook and I was doing salads and stuff, but I would look over the dessert station and we had an amazing pastry program. It was like three different pastry chefs, no pastry assistants. That's where I slipped in. And then I got to learn under Elaine Spear, who's I still credit as my pastry mentor.
Where was this in the timeline? How old are you at this point?
22.
So yeah. Just out of college?
I was still in college.
Okay. Where'd you go to school?
New Hampshire Institute of Art, but before that I went to NHIA.
Okay.
Yeah, up in Concord. So.
Gotcha.
Because I was like,
so you're living in Manchester?
Yes.
Okay. So back to CR's Sparks.
Yes.
So you start noticing what's going on in the kitchen. Take it back to that train of thought.
Just seeing everything done, you know, from scratch was amazing. I still remember having my first creme brulee ever there. That was like a very much an aha moment for me. And just as I said, Elaine Spear, my pastry mentor, like watching her, we had like a couple of the other pastry chefs, like I'm not going to, you know, shit talk them, but you know, they were kind of a little hasty with like how they executed things, but Elaine just had such a soft hands with things and like playful. And I picked up like her whimsical aspects to dessert, where it doesn't have to be like this fussiness that you see a lot in like fine dining. So I kind of took that concept from her and like ran with it and have since with my career. So
what was the appeal then? What was pulling you in the kitchen then? What was like the inspiration for you to follow this interest?
I'm not sure really, because I was like, you know, of course I was passionate about art. I basically was down to either going to art school or culinary school, and I realized I could learn more in art school. I felt anyways. I know a lot of people. It's basically like what you make of it when it comes to college, but I felt like I could learn more and work through kitchens if I were to, you know, pursue that instead of going to culinary school full time. I don't know. I've just always been passionate about food.
God. So, hindsight being 2020, do you think you made the right call?
Yes.
Why is that?
100%. I'm very thankful for my art school career, and I'm you know, thrilled with the skill set I have. I wouldn't do it any other way.
I agree. I mean, I think that the skills that you picked up, being able to promote yourself and market mm-hmm. yourself, mm-hmm. With the illustration and all that, is a huge asset. Like, and to your point, yeah, you can go to work anywhere in the country. If you yep. are good at what you do, if you're talented, if you have work ethic, Taurus, you could go anywhere in the world. There's an opportunity for you. And
yeah.
you can learn everything that you need to know to go do your own thing. But to have the skills, I feel like, to really promote and to like create a brand around yourself, mm-hmm. that is super, super valuable skill to have.
Oh,
and
for sure.
Your brand is great, too.
I appreciate
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So when... was there a point like where you started saying to yourself, I want to be my own, I want to own my own business someday? Like, when did that come into your mind?
I think it was just always end game. Like, I think it's like, you know, the hierarchy of things. Like, you know, I was a little pastry assistant, then I want to be the pastry chef, and then I want to go to executive pastry chef. And then you start going, well, I probably should own my own place at some point.
So what was the evolution for you? Was it just that, what you said?
For the most part, yeah.
Okay, awesome. So what were the points of, like, transformation for you? Like, the biggest points of growth in terms of your ability and in terms of, like, your professionalism?
Well, I always tell people now, I definitely faked it until I made it.
Right.
Like, I still remember my first, like, if you want to even call it executive pastry chef job, it was down here when Republic was still a thing here on Elm Street. And I can't remember what happened with the pastry chef there. She either left or, like, got let go. And they're like, well, you do pastry, right? You could do this. So I revamped all her recipes. And, like, they were simple. It was, like, chocolate mousse, lemon bars, stuff like that. But, like, slowly making that my own. But, I mean... as I will tell people, I screwed up a lot of stuff before I got good.
Okay. So take me actually, like, let's zoom at the 30,000 feet and starting with CR, because that's where you kind of got your start, right?
CRs. Yeah.
What year was that? 2007,
I think?
Seven? Damn, we're going way back.
Yeah.
Take me through your career without getting into detail, just like the stops, like dates and locations.
Yeah.
Go.
So I worked.
CRs.
CRs, and then. I want to say Republic was after that.
Okay. And how long were you there?
I was at Republic until the end of art school, so 2011.
Okay. And then where did you go after that?
Eastern Standard.
Eastern Standard.
That Garrett, was, I basically, he's wonderful. I love Garrett.
How long were you there?
I was there for only a few months.
Okay. What was the point of going there?
So basically it's like one of those things, where you graduate college and you have the fear of paying yeah. back student loans. So I was like, I need to go somewhere where I can make a lot of money. And I was like, that's where I was front of house.
Okay.
Yeah. I served there.
Was that around 2011 too?
Yep.
Around 2011. There mm-hmm. only a few months. Okay. Keep going along that train of thought. Just your stops along the way.
And, after that I started serving at the Beehive in the South End.
Okay. And how long were you there?
Like 6 months.
Okay, so we're getting close to 2012.
Yeah.
What was after that?
Well, the funny part about Beehive was the executive sous chef there, Scott Jensen, he owns the Quiet Few in Eastie. Wonderful human. I consider him my brother. I still remember another one of those things where cookies come into play. I brought cookies into work, and I just remember him pulling me by the shoulders into the side server station. He's like, why are you serving? And I'm like, I don't know. What are you talking about? He's like, you can tell that you care, like, with how you cook. You should be in the kitchen. I'm like, well, I want to make money. And, like, back then it was like, you know, a pastry chef was probably making $15 an hour if you were lucky.
Yep.
And I'm like, I need to be able to survive, you know, the Boston market and be able to afford an apartment. So, you know, eventually he gave me the nudge to get back into the kitchen for sure.
Okay. So this is kind of like the first time where you really got encouraged to like focus on your talent and your passion.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was around 2012, you said?
It's like 2011 to 2012.
Okay.
And at that time I was also working mornings at Russo's in Watertown, which was like a very well-known like grocery store, but it had a beautiful bakery and like deli counter, that kind of stuff. I was the bakery manager there.
Got it.
And I tell people like on a Saturday weekend, I would frost between 150 and 200 cakes before 8 a.m.
Holy shit. That's crazy. So it sounds like it was like around 2012-ish where you're starting to get encouraged to get out of the front of house and put more of an effort into your talent, your passion back of house. And was it at Russo's where you really started to make that your full-time focus?
For the most part, yeah. That I'm happy to work at places like that. Like, I always tell people whatever experience you or job or anything that you're put into, see what you can gain from it.
Okay.
And that was one of those where I got to gain, like, basic, like, you know, frosting cake skills, doing stuff in high volume.
How long were you there?
I was there for a year.
A year? Okay. Yeah. So, like, 2013?
Yeah.
Okay. What was after that?
God. I know during that time, I want to say my first pastry chef job was with Andy Husbands.
Okay.
When Tremont 647 was the thing.
I probably had him on the show for the first time when you were working there.
Probably.
How long were you there for?
It's been on and off. I've gone back to work for Andy like 3 or 4 times now.
Okay. But what came like after like that, I guess?
During that time too, I was also, I've worked so many places. I worked at the Triton Bookstore too at the same time. I was a cafe manager.
Okay. Triton Bookstore?
Trident
Bookstore.
It's like an iconic bookstore that's on Newbury Street in Boston.
So when would you say, would it be Andy Husband's that was like the first, at Tremont, that was like the first, like,
yeah,
you are a pastry chef?
Yeah, he gave me full rein and he was like, here, create a menu.
Okay. Bring us to that point.
Okay.
I'm fishing for like the key highlight points of your career.
My life is like...
To talk about the evolution. I want to focus on the evolution.
Yeah.
So, what were the biggest struggles during this time of being kind of handed the reins?
Just trying to find an identity for the most part. Like, I just didn't know, like, it's when you're giving free rein, it sounds like it's amazing. But like, if you don't have an identity yourself, like in what you do, it's so difficult. So, you know, trying to construct menus and not understanding menu structure.
What do you mean by menu structure?
So I always tell people when I'm doing pastry menus, especially if it's like an abbreviated menu, it's not like, you know, 5 or 6 desserts, it's 3. I always tell people you want to make sure you have something for everybody. I always do a chocolate dessert, something fruited, something fried. So that's always how I structure things. But I didn't know that back then. I'd be like, yeah, oh, 2 chocolate desserts and this and like, you know.
Yeah, you want to reach a broad appeal of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And always, I always laugh when someone doesn't have a chocolate dessert on their menu because I'm like, you need to have one.
Yeah.
Like people, regardless, will order it.
I'm a dark chocolate Me sucker. Too. I have such a weakness for dark. I love it.
Me too.
So as long as there's one chocolate, I'm usually happy.
Yeah.
So structuring the menu to have a mass appeal, what else?
Also just like... I knew how to do certain things really well, but I just still had so much growing to do.
Give me an example of where you were, like, of why you were not quite there yet in terms of growth.
Just because I think it's like a lot of my experience. I'm like this. A lot of my experience was, I don't know. I just didn't work under enough people at that time.
Right.
Yeah. And that was like a struggle for me because like I had to learn on the fly or I'd be looking at like, you know, on my phone for recipes and like just having no experience with this stuff. So I'm like, oh, maybe it looks like that. Maybe this is how it's supposed to look and just screwing up a bunch of stuff.
Knowing what you know now with all the experience you've had and different perspective, looking at that version of yourself, what were you missing? Was it just perspective and experience?
Yeah.
And
confidence, honestly.
So, like, if you could fast track and give yourself advice to that person then, like, what would your advice for yourself have been?
Not be afraid of the failure.
Okay.
I feel like that stunted me a lot because I was so afraid of screwing up all the time.
What specifically were you afraid of?
Getting yelled at.
Okay.
I just hated that feeling, you know. And Andy has a way of, you know, I mean, I always tell people he's my Boston dad, but just some of the conversations I had with him and, you know, this first pastry chef job, like... It's like the disappointed dad conversation. It's like, this could have been better. I'm like, I know. Like, it's never a good feeling, but now he talks to me. He's like, I'm so proud of you. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks.
That's awesome. How did you discover him or he discover you?
Really small world. So he was on a season of Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
And one of my friends worked at Sierra Sparks with me, was on his season.
Oh, okay.
Jim McGloin. And then his then at the time girlfriend, Amanda Tech, she goes by, is one of my best friends now. So
okay, cool.
Yeah, so they introduced me. They're like, we should go to Tournament 647. They're doing a watch party. There's a famous like episode where he cut his fingers open on a mandolin.
Oh, shit.
That was the one we watched.
Oh, man. So, that's crazy. Yeah. So looking back at your career at Tremont, we're right around about 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
What were the biggest points of evolution for you? Because I know you have given yourself tons of perspective, mm-hmm. tons of places to work. So like, where do you think you've grown the most?
Probably during that time for like after I left Tremont 647, I had the pleasure of working for Josh Lewin. He owns Juliet in Somerville. Wonderful human. I love Josh. So at the time, there was a cocktail bar, and it's still there, in the South End called Wink and Nod. So the bar was the standard. Like, it was, like, there. But then the kitchen was a rotating kitchen program. So they used it as, like, an incubator program. So every 6 months, they would have a different, you know, group of humans coming in and executing their menu to go with the cocktails. And we were operating under the guise of bread and salt. So I was essentially Josh's pastry chef and sous chef.
Okay.
And he pushed me a lot. He made me more confident in what I, you know, did.
So you and Josh took over this space at Wink and Nod.
Yes.
Which essentially you guys were a pop-up.
Yeah.
What year is this? 2014-ish?
Yeah, 13, 14.
14? Okay. Yeah. I think this is like when pop-ups really, I mean, there's so much opportunity to collaborate.
Yeah.
And to like get out of the traditional model. I love these opportunities where if you can get your foot in the door and start putting out your stuff, and especially if that location is giving you liberty to like own your stuff and mm-hmm. put your brand on it and like promote your brand to their audience. Was that happening, or were you guys just kind of behind the scenes?
Oh, we definitely promote. Josh was definitely like in the limelight a lot. He was up and coming, and he already got a lot of attention because he was, I think the year before was Zagat 30 under 30.
Okay.
And then I got it that year.
Oh, wow.
Which is cool. So that was like when stuff started to come on the up and up, and I started to get attention. And as I said, I had more confidence because of Josh. So he allowed me to, he reined in, like, as I said, where I didn't know menu structure, he helped me rein that in.
What did you learn about yourself during this time?
This is like when I really start to have my identity in food.
Okay.
Like the whimsical touches. I always tell people, I like most humans now, all of us diagnosed, my type of ADHD is I love being armed with information. Mm-hmm. So I will fixate on like an ingredient and see all the different ways I can do it and like use it in like, you know, unexpected contexts, or I'll explore like, you know, a certain type of cuisine and like see what ingredients are and like stuff that I've never been exposed to. I grew up in for lack of better words, I grew up in a very bland household. You know, like my mom thinks, you know, mayonnaise is too spicy, but it's so as soon as I got out of, you know, the house and was eating on my own, like my eyes just opened. I was like, holy crap. Like, yeah. There's a whole world out there. You
Especially
know?
Around that time, I think post 2007, the world of food just kind of exploded.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, like the iPhones around, people are sharing all this food from all over the country. And it was like constantly like one up, one up, one up. And food flavors, ethnic foods were just exploding too.
Yeah. And that's like, especially when I got to Boston, like exploring like different markets and whatnot. Like I lived in Quincy at the time, so we have so many awesome Asian markets, and just walking in there on days off and being like, all right, I'm going to look at these ingredients and like, you know, so, what can I make with them?
You know? So you started to feel a little bit more yourself in your cooking.
Yeah.
And getting that sense of identity and mm-hmm. like in your approach. What about like, at what point did you learn about like the actual ins and outs of the business of food?
Like in what aspect?
So like, it's one thing to be a pastry chef and to be handed the ingredients and to make the food. But what about like costing? What about building a business model around your ability?
I will say Josh taught me all that.
Okay.
Because it was one of those things. I was so like, I was his number two. Okay. So I was always over his shoulder. And like, he taught me how to do so many things like ordering and like budgeting and all that kind of stuff and keeping our costs. Like, you know, this is what we, you know, made on this Saturday night. This is like the cost we need to cover. Like I got to see everything like firsthand with him, which is like, I always felt like, yeah, I mean, it's intimidating for sure. You know, it's not like, you know, make believe money. It's like, right. No, this is real. It's like, oh my God. Like,
how long were you with Josh?
I was with Josh for almost 2 years.
2 years. So yeah. Like into 2016.
It must have been a year, yeah.
Okay. So Go ahead.
And one of the cooler things was with him, that was my first time cooking at the James Beard House.
Oh, yeah. Nice. What ultimately made you leave Josh?
He was going to open Juliet, but it was just such a short timeline. Like he thought it was going to be a short timeline, but it ended up being, of course, like any openings, it just dragged out longer.
Whatever you think it is, add a year, add $1 million.
Yeah. And I got the opportunity to open Yvonne's in Downtown Crossing. So I was the opening pastry chef there. It was the old Lockover space, an iconic restaurant in Boston that, you know, Lockover that was open for 150 years.
Was it called Lockover?
Lockober.
Lockober.
L-O-C-K-E, and then it's Ober, O-B-E-R.
So it's safe to say, like, you really kind of, like, Andy Husbands was the first person to really take a risk on you in terms of creative, right?
And he always saw the creativity in me, and, like, he still sees that. He's like, you just always have, like, fun, playful ideas. Like, yeah, sometimes they didn't work out, but, like, he gave me the room to explore those things. Yeah.
And did he encourage you to go get different perspective, or did you want to get out from underneath?
I want to get out from underneath him. Like, as I said, he's Boston Dad. So, like, you know, of course he's going to have his input and, like, you know, be a little bit controlling sometimes. Yeah. He still will give his input, and then I just sass him back now. And he's like, heard, understood. Like, he understands me now, where I'm, like, you know, grown into myself. And I'm just like, no, I appreciate your feedback, but I'm good.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
And then you knew that working with Josh would help you get that perspective.
For sure.
Keep going.
We definitely have, like, a brother-sister dynamic, and, like, he gave me a lot of tough love, and, I don't know, like, he still had a soft hand with me, and I always appreciate it.
I'm not familiar with Josh. Is he a pastry chef? Is that what he does?
No, he's a chef.
He's a chef? Yeah. So you were just doing pastry for him?
Yep.
Got it.
Pastry and sous chef, so I did a lot of savory cooking, too, and whatnot, so.
Got it. And basically, from what I heard, it sounds like Juliet was opening, but it wasn't opening fast enough for you. So you needed,
I needed money coming in. So,
and then you found yourself at with Evans or Yvonne's.
Yvonne's. Yeah.
Sorry, Yvonne's. How long were you there?
I was there for a little over a year.
Okay. I mean, tons of little experiences here and there. I mean, I think a year is a good time when you're trying to find yourself.
Yeah.
Give at least a year.
Yeah.
What was your longest tenure?
God. It might have been Lincoln and Capo after that. I was there for like a year and a half.
Okay. So,
but it's sad because this is like where the timeline gets a little dicey. And I'm not here to trash people, even though they should be. This is where I started working in Toxic Kitchens when I worked at Yvonne's.
Well, okay. So that was the first experience with Toxic
Kitchens? Yeah. And it was like a super hyper-focused situation I was in.
Okay. Well, I don't need to bring names, and I'm not trying to.
Oh, no, of course not. We don't need to slander people.
Yeah, for sure. But like, without bringing the names in, let's learn from your experience. Like, what was happening? What were you seeing that wasn't good?
Definitely like a male dominated kitchen, which, I mean, that happens. It's just like the industry, but just how I was treated. Essentially what happened was our culinary director was not supposed to be on site. He was supposed to consult from afar, from Nantucket, and come to find out eventually, like, you know, there's kind of shakeups with like what was going on with his personal life, and ended up moving to Boston to be on premise all the time. But the one thing in the back of my head, I was already hired, but I knew his partner was the pastry chef in Nantucket.
Okay.
So I knew there was a target on my back, and I was like, I have a feeling something's going to happen.
Okay.
And I never liked that feeling.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things. So I'm just like, and it, you know, in hindsight, you know, I haven't spoken to this individual since, but I wish he understood, like, you know, I wish people would take employment at will more seriously. He could have had a conversation with me after I got hired and been like, hey, I think you're great, but I want my girlfriend to be the pastry chef, and no hard feelings. Right. I wish that was the case.
Is that what ended up happening? Were you replaced? Were you?
I was slowly pushed out. I was, instead of having that conversation, I was verbally abused every day. I was taken in an office with no cameras, and I wasn't criticized on my actual execution of stuff. I was criticizing my personal character. I was told I was worthless, like, you know, horrible. Like, and I told people this is the start of, I started to have panic attacks, not knowing what they were. We had a private dining room downstairs, and I would hide in the bathroom for like the first hour of the day, having a full blown panic attack, trying to get my shit together before I'd start my shift.
How old were you at this point, would you say, if you had a guess?
32, I think.
32?
Yeah.
I mean, what would you tell a young woman who was going through where you're going, like, what knowing what you know now about how to protect yourself and stand up for yourself, what would you have done differently in that situation?
I wish I stood up for, I always tell people, and it like breaks my heart, it's like, I wish I stood up for that girl. I wish I stood up for myself then. I wish I said something. I wish I said more.
Right.
And I wish I just had someone that cared, because I you know, I tried to talk to some of my managers and they were kind of just like, oh, that's just the way it is. And I'm just like, no, like no one needs to go through it. And I found out later on this wasn't just me. It was a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
But it was just like, it was to the point where they also, a lot of the male management was turned against me. And it was always like, oh, she's lazy. She's this. And I'm like, I'm there almost every freaking day. And yeah, I was screwing up a lot because I was under so much pressure. And like, I couldn't function as a person.
Right. When you don't feel, when you're literally afraid.
Yeah.
Like you show up in a different way. Your mind, your frontal lobe gets consumed with fear-based thought, and like you're not focusing on what you're doing. You're thinking about how much you fucking hate where you are and the people you're working with, and that absorbs your attention, your ability to do the job. Yeah. I don't know about you, but when I get yelled at, I can't work. I don't function in the kitchen.
I can't.
My emotions flare, and I just think about how much I want to like murder the person yelling at.
Oh yeah.
Like that's all I think about, and you just end up, and it just compounds. You just start making more mistakes.
And it was such a hard situation because, you know, everybody, I was getting so much amazing affirmation from my peers in the industry. Like, you know, I would, you know, I'd go in the dining room and I see my friends and they're just like, oh my God, you're crushing it. And like, this is amazing. And like, I put out a lot of really good product there. I'm the reason why there's a Baked Alaska on the menu and everything, like that iconic one everyone sees on Instagram. And, you know, hearing all that, but then like going back in the kitchen and just being ridiculed. It was just such a hard, you know, pill to swallow. And also, I didn't realize that leaving was an option, because I think I got so in my head. I'm like, no, this is supposed to be the next step in my career. This is a high profile, you know, opening. Like, you can't leave. But I also wasn't making enough money either. Right.
Well, the other thing, too, is if you bounce around a lot as a young employee, like, it's not going to look good. It's going to be harder for you to get that job if you're only there for 3 months. Like, why only 3 months at this location? Like, people are going to think that you just, you're jumping around, or you're not, just doesn't look good to be anywhere for a short period of time.
Yeah.
So how long were you there ultimately?
I want to say it was like a little over a year.
A little over a year?
Yeah.
And then what made you get out? Was it just because you never felt like...
I just had like a breaking point one day.
Bring us to that point.
Where I still remember, it was something super simple where I walked upstairs because my kitchen was in the basement and I was in the middle of like making stuff downstairs. I had stuff actively in the oven and I had a birthday cake that needed to go out to a table. And apparently I had to wait at the pass or something like for the server to intercept it. Or it might have been a Baked Alaska. That's why I needed to light it, because I would go out and like tableside light stuff. And this server was taking way too long. So I looked at our executive sous chef. I'm like, hey, can you execute this for me? I have stuff in the oven. And it's that simple.
Yeah.
All he was doing was standing at the pass doing nothing. So what I thought was fine wasn't. The next day, I come in the side door, come up those stairs to the kitchen to him shit-talking me to the other sous chef. He has his back to me, the executive sous chef. And I could just see my sous chef who's looking at me. His eyes get big like, she's right behind you. She's right behind you. And I just like looked at this kid. I was like, I can't. I literally like went downstairs, called my mom. I'm like, I have to get out of here. I have to get out of here. And he came downstairs and like gave me some like half-ass like, well, it's just like, you know, I'm like, no, what you did. That was the first time I actually like barked at him. I was just like, what you did wasn't okay. There's no way of getting out of this.
I kind of want to, I mean, you're getting really vulnerable right now and I appreciate that. What did he say? I'm curious. Could you hear what he was saying?
I think it was to the extent like, I can't believe she fucking did that. She's so fucking lazy. Like, and I'm like, what did I ask you to do? You're the one standing at the pass doing nothing.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we've all been there in the kitchen where like an element of what you're working on gets away from you and you need to step away.
Yeah.
So you don't have to but throw also, something
I,
away.
I like, communicated it. Yeah. So it's just like this is what we're here for.
Everyone covers each other. It's a team.
Yeah. You know? It's like if I couldn't do it all on my own, they're just like, oh, she's lazy. She's this. And
we've
like,
all been there where we've jumped off our station to go give somebody a hand because of some out of our control. Like you were doing it for the server.
Yeah.
You stepped off your station pastry to go help.
Yeah. He was too busy at a table selling a bottle of wine. I'm like, all right.
You're
like,
going to burn something.
Yeah.
Like, can you cover me so I don't have to do this over? And we're all screwed,
it was something so simple and that happened. Right. So that's when I started to make the plan. I was like, I have to leave.
Yeah.
And I ended up going up to my AGM and I gave her my notice because I couldn't give it to my culinary director because I was terrified.
This is like 2016.
Right? Yeah.
So we're going back on about 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Where are you professionally at this point? Like, what's your goals? Like, do you have goals? Do you have a vision for yourself, a place you're trying to be?
Right now?
No, in 2018.
I just was trying to keep my head above water at that point. Yeah. I was in such a bad headspace. I still remember my last day. So it was Memorial Day weekend and the culinary director and our executive chef were off in Nantucket for Nantucket Wine Weekend. And so they weren't on premise. So they had these little underlings like running the kitchen. And I made sure that the day before I got all my stuff out, I, you know, came in early. I did a full day's work, like, you know, 9 hours, and did all my bread baking. Everything was left pristine. And I knew that, of course, the culinary director's girlfriend was taking over for me. But I kill people with kindness. I knew she was going to have to flip the
menu.
You
brought treats today. Did they all get their treat before leaving?
No.
Oh, no.
It'll be fine.
Okay. Sorry.
That's okay.
Keep going. Kill people with kindness.
I kill people with kindness. So I knew she would need time to flip my menu. So I left her stacked. Like, for a normal, like, week, we would have, like, 12 baked Alaskas in the freezer. I left her with 52.
Wow.
So I made sure she, like, everything, just tons. So this happened to be that holiday weekend. So that Sunday, we normally would do, like, 90 covers. We had 280. Because everybody knew there was a Monday holiday. So, or you know, Monday was, I can't remember how it worked out, but I knew, like, the Sunday was going to be super busy. So I'm, like, cleaning up and everything. And all of a sudden, my sous chef comes downstairs. He's like, yeah, so you need to stay for service. And I'm like, no, I don't. And he's like, I need counts on everything. I'm like, no, you don't. We're not running. I don't care how big. If we do 500 cover, we're not running out of anything. And he's like, I need counts on things. And I was like, whatever. So him and the other sous chefs were like, well, we're going to have a meeting upstairs, you know, for pre-meal. We need you up there. I'm like, all right, cool. I'll be up there shortly. So because of how the restaurant is, like all the, I wouldn't even say like tunnels, but like how everything is downstairs. On the other side of the kitchen, you go like to the private dining room, and beyond that is all the bar prep. So I went over there, said goodbye to a bunch of my bartenders, letting them know like I'm leaving, because I was like, I'm going to walk out. And by that, I mean I fulfilled a full day. So I'm not technically walking out.
Yeah.
I also was on the way to meet my boyfriend at the time, parents in New Jersey. So I had my suitcase by the back door. So I start going up the back stairs, and I saw my executive sous chef come out of the office, and he saw me. So I bolt. I literally bolt through our back alley. I start running through Downtown Crossing with my suitcase so I can catch the next bus to New York City to go to New Jersey. And I had my phone going off, and it was my executive chef. And he calls me twice. And I'm sitting there. I could feel the panic. And all of a sudden, it just washed over me. I go, I don't owe you anything. What are you going to call me for? What are you going to yell at me to tell me to come back? Come back to the abusive kitchen? No, your boys can handle it. I'm all fucking sad.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like the pastry chef is probably one of the more well-known positions that get abused.
Yes.
Why is that?
I have no idea. Like, I there's always just such a point of contention between, like, savory and pastry. Like, I never want to discredit anybody, but it's always, like, I feel like people think we don't do a lot. And I'm like, yeah, our costs are different, and like, yeah, we don't sell as much as savory food, but there's such an art to what we do, and like, yeah. And also we take over bread programs, and we do stuff for brunch, and you know, right. People want all these, you know, lavish things, but they don't realize how much care goes into it.
Right, and it's kind of like front of house, back of house, like, yeah. Like where like I think it's because you don't work with those people, you generally probably come in before everybody, yeah. You're probably like there in the morning or late at night. And like you're sharing space, so like you see, you're being seen but not being seen.
Yeah,
where like you're, what's being seen from you is like how you left something that somebody else might not like it that way.
Yeah,
so like you're just constantly at odds, like, yeah. Literally working different hours, you're using the same space, and like it's just kind of like when you don't take the time to learn and understand and like,
yeah.
Think about, there's a person and maybe that person has a reason for doing it this way. You can't empathize because you never see them.
Yeah,
it's like I think that they're kind of like outsiders in a sense. Like that's what I picked up.
Yeah.
And I also, around other pastry chefs.
And I also tell people in this position as well, is this has helped for me as a better manager, because I wish someone during that time when they saw how bad of a headspace I was in and like I was fucking up and like I was just in a really bad place. Yeah. I had to go to therapy actively. Like that's when I started actively going to therapy because I was so screwed up in the head during that time. And this is how I became a better manager, because now I apply that to when I work in places. Like when you see that one employee who's like fumbling over stuff or calling out or whatnot, I wish people would approach them instead of being like, oh, you know, screw them, fire them. It's like, no, how about you ask first? Like, hey, is everything okay? Like, what's going on at home? Like, is there anything
I can... Don't let us boil
yeah.
up.
Yeah. It's just like, and that's when, you know, we talk about the mental health in the industry. It's like, I wish people would start with that first. Instead of like jumping to conclusions, firing people, it's like everybody has stuff going on beyond these four walls.
I'm actually really excited to announce their ads won't be going live at the time this goes live, but confirmed our sponsorship with the National Council for Better Mental Health.
Awesome.
Is going to be a sponsor of the show because this is really important.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's creating that safe space.
Yeah.
Where you feel like you can speak up, where you feel like you're making people feel like they aren't shit. you're reinforcing them, not breaking them down.
Yeah.
You're building them up, not breaking them down.
Yeah.
You're like, you're clearly being broken down before.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you, like, was at this point, I mean, knowing what you know now, how you handled that, mm-hmm. just leaving, do you think you did the right thing, or would there have been a better way of doing that?
I mean, it played out the way it played out. You know, I burned bridges. Like, I miss the executive chef. Him and I were friends. I was there through a lot of hard times for him, and he just wasn't there for me. And that mm-hmm. was one of the things that really hurt me, is he was too busy being, like, the cool kid. Like, of course, they were, like, buying stuff on the company dime and, like, going to have these lavish lunches and yeah. dinners that I was never invited to. And just being cool kids, and we're going to gun for James Beard, and we're going to do this. And I'm just like, so what? You know? Like, this is not what's important. How about you serve your community and
yeah.
those kind of things? And just seeing that people get so far away from that. So I feel good about what I did. It's taken a long time to reconcile all that, just because I was made to feel terrible for what I did. Like, there was, like, whisperings in the industry and, like, you know, she can't keep a job. She's this. She's, of course, I got pinned as, like, you know, she's hard to hire. She's crazy. And I'm just like, no, I stood up for myself. Yeah, I handled as best as I could at the time with the headspace I was in. So I'm not going to be mad at myself for, you know, yeah. what everybody says now. You can't be mad at yourself for when you were in survival mode.
Right.
And I'm just like, yeah, I was basically fighting for my life at that point. Right.
So, I mean, there's a certain point where the ownership has to take responsibility of not creating that space where people yeah. feel like they can stick around.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's we're trying to kill right now at this podcast.
Yeah. It's really hard because with them, I do like the ownership.
Yeah.
Like, the actual owners are nice. They always treat me well. I got a Christmas bonus, all that. Like, yeah. I do like them. But it's just one of those things. And I hate being, you know, the woman that says it, but it's like the toxic boys club. They protect their boys. It's like, yeah, he creates, like, good food for you, but, like, he's a shitty person right. to his core.
Yeah.
Like, watching this guy do what he did to me with, like, no remorse. And I'm just like, you think that's okay? And you've done that to other people, and no one has, like, reeled you in. And I've seen it do it to his partner. I'm just like, how do you wake up
yeah.
every day and look in the mirror and go, I'm fine with this?
Right.
Like, it's
right.
disgusting.
So good on you for having the courage to walk away from that.
Mm-hmm.
What was, like, after that, you're going to New York or Connecticut to meet your boyfriend at the time, like, family for mm-hmm. holidays or whatever. This is about 8 years ago.
Yeah.
When did you start Lionheart Confection?
So I started in the face of the pandemic.
So 2020.
Yeah.
So 4 years after this moment in your career,
yeah.
you start your own, at this point, it's essentially a pop-up, right?
Yes.
So what happened in that four-year period? And I want to kind of start transitioning to your business, your story yeah. of your business, your advice for pop-ups and all that. But were there points of evolution in this four-year period from 2016 to 2020 where, like, you think you got really set up to go out on your own? Like, what was the point of evolution for you here?
Mine was, as I said, like, every job you have, you take something with you and you do it better. So I started to really hone in on what I want to do and, like, what my voice was in, like, my food. I do a lot of, I do pretty plates. I went to art school, so I'm all about aesthetic for sure. I like really fun, whimsical flavors. I always tell people when I do a dish, I usually do between 3 and 5 flavors. But at least one of them, half the time you don't know, but you trust all the other flavors around it. That's how you gain the trust and almost have, like, a unspoken dialogue with a guest. They're like, well, I like all these other things, but I don't know what that is. And they get exposed to different things, which yeah. is, like, super cool. That's just how my brain works. I like textures. I always tell people when it comes to pastry, the 3 major things I always tell any of my assistants are make sure your salt levels are good, make sure there's acid, and texture. A lot of those things get overlooked. Like, I always tell people the quintessential dessert that I know a lot of people like that I don't care for is tiramisu. Because it's...
I love tiramisu. You don't like the muckiness?
It's a pile of mush. So when I do tiramisu, I actually put a layer of crunchies in it.
Okay.
Kind of like an ice cream cake.
I love tiramisu.
Yeah. I'm all about texture, so...
That sounds good, though, the crunchiness. I think I'd like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So you're really starting to really, like, now you're getting repetitions in and you're yeah. starting to figure out, like, you know, you're known for your creativity with the visual appeal.
Yeah.
But you're really just trying to figure out, like, how can I put my spin on this? Having the ingredients, yeah. the unknown, the mystery, the secret, the spark curiosity.
Yeah.
And then not making sure any element of the completion of the dish, like texture or acidity or salt, like it's balanced. It's yeah. holistic. So now you're just feeling like you're confident.
Mm-hmm.
When do you say to yourself, I want to start my own? Like, when did the words Lionheart Confection come into your mind?
It came, so I knew as soon as the pandemic hit, I was working at a restaurant on the North Shore As soon as that happened, I was, once again, I was like, there's a target on my back, because as soon as restrictions came down, they started to make cuts, they dropped all of us to hourly. I was like, how long before I'm furloughed or let go? Because pastry is a luxury, and a lot of people are like, well, that's the first to go, you know? So the answer is 3 months. And I still remember, because
so June of 2020.
Yeah. So I remember I literally slept for like 2 weeks. Like, I would get up like after sleeping till noon and move to the couch and then take a nap. Like, I could tell my body, because I was so overworked, my body just needed to crash.
Right.
Like, my partner at the time would look, he's like, did you get off the couch today? Did you shower? I'm like, no. He's like, good. Like, he's like, you move too much. I'm like, yeah, I know. And like, I just like crash. So,
well, just emotionally too. Just your physical working for like the years before that, but like,
it catches up to you.
Yeah. Just like the industry collectively was mentally ill.
Yeah.
And we, cause we, all we do is head down, gear, grind. We're playing the finite game, trying to be number one, win that thing, get this recognition at our own, at the expense of ourselves. Yeah. And then the hammer was dropped. The universe said, you have to stop. You don't have an option.
Yeah.
And it was this time of self-reflection and awakening. And I think, and rest, you know, and like reflect, like just, so how long before you decided to launch Lionheart Confections?
I want to say it was September. That's why I finally, because I started to be like, well, I guess I had to do like what everybody else does. And like, let's find a remote job. I think I was on Craigslist for 10 minutes and I was like, I can't do this.
So like 3 months from basically being furloughed to.
Yeah. I was doing like a lot of cakes and stuff. Like people still knew I was still, you know, taking cake orders and stuff. So, and that also my favorite, I didn't, as much as I come off as an extrovert, I'm definitely an introvert. Like my battery, social battery goes down. I realize that. I'll like leave. So I'm the queen of the Irish goodbye. I'm just like, oh, this is too much. But my favorite part about the pandemic was not having to interact with people. Like I'd bake a cake and they're like, can you leave it on my porch? I'm like, yes. I'm like, Venmo me money. Like I don't have to talk to you. I don't have to make weird small talk to people I don't really know. I do love the people that support me, believe me, but I just, I have a real hard time.
You only got
with
so
it.
Much to give though. I get it.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk about the evolution of Lionheart Confections.
This episode is brought to you by Mies. Running the back of house brings a whole suite of challenges, like distributing intellectual property from your chef's brain to your back of house team across all of your locations. Once that information gets distributed, you still have to train your back of house to ensure the recipes are being executed accurately and consistently. Once everybody is trained, you still have to nail down profit calculations, which can be a nightmare when your team doesn't fully understand theoretical food costs, factoring in yields, and unit conversions. Then, once all this is done, you still have to push the information across all of your locations in real time, factoring in the prices that are constantly changing. Are you kidding me? That's where Mies comes in. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary intellectual property and stay in sync as a team. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material. And you can get laser accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yields of your ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Mies account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. This episode is brought to you by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, used cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to those messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. RTI's services are not limited to oil. They also provide insurance premiums and automated hood cleaning solutions plus hood filtration systems, making your hood cleaning process easy, automatic, and worry-free. In addition to all this, Restaurant Technologies, Inc. can help you reduce your carbon footprint, which we all know is becoming increasingly more important to the consumer. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way.
So when you started with Lionheart, what was the vision?
Basically, I wanted to show people like the woman I've become, and also show other women in the industry like you can be strong. Like, it's okay to be outspoken. It's okay to be brave. So I wanted a brand that encompassed that. And this is also a really funny point of contention. He can tell you about it, Andy Husbands, when he was giving me advice when I announced the name of my company. And he's like, hey, I think it's like, I can't remember his wording, but it was just like, I think it's a little aggressive. But you also have to figure, like, one of his best friends is Joanne Chang. Okay. She has Flower. It's wildly successful. It's like very, you know, her branding's brilliant. But a lot of bakeries are like, you know, sugar and flour and sweet and cute. And I'm just like, that's not me. I'm very bold and sassy. And like, I just want to, you know, show people I'm tenacious and that kind of thing. So
are you a Leo?
I'm very much a Leo.
Yeah. August birthday?
July. July 30th.
I'm August. Leo too. I dig it. So you just wanted to create something that was an extension of who you are.
Yes.
I love that. Did you know you were going to be doing pop-ups for a long time? Was the goal to get to a brick and mortar? Like, what was the vision in terms?
I kind of wasn't thinking at the time. I knew during this time, during the pandemic, and especially the last restaurant I worked at, people were just seeking comfort food. Like, anything you could put in front of them, they wanted to buy. Because they just, you know, they weren't going out to restaurants. So they're just like, I want that restaurant experience at home. Like, I still remember one day, before I got furloughed, we spun 64 quarts of ice cream.
Wow.
And they sold out within a couple of days. It was, like, utterly insane. I'm like, we have never gone through that much.
That's crazy.
So I always knew, I'm like, what can I do for a pop-up? You know, I started this confection. And I put confections because I wanted to have a broad scope.
What is a confection?
Just like pastries.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Not sugar. I didn't want to be like Lionheart Donuts, Lionheart Cakes. Like, I didn't want to pigeonhole myself. I wanted to have, like, you know, be able to do the full spectrum. And I'm blanking here.
Well, no, I think that's really smart long term because it opens yourself up. And really, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but what I'm seeing this trend that, like, it's you don't want to create a one-stop shop concept that does it all because it's too hard to be good at everything.
Yeah.
So I think by having an overarching brand, Lionheart Confections, LLC, and to your point, you can spin off. You can do Lionheart Donuts, Lionheart fill in the blanks.
Yeah, like exactly.
Any savory thing that can stand on its own.
Yeah.
You know, and create a whole brand around that or like a whole store around that.
Yeah.
And then like vertically integrate everything.
Yeah. And so I realized, like, at a bunch of restaurants I worked at that we would do donuts on brunch, especially at the last restaurant I worked in on North Shore, is, like, people would call ahead, like, several days and be like, where are the flavors this weekend? And you're like, I haven't even gotten that far. Like, chill. And I realized that, you know, maybe I should do donut pop-ups. So basically what I'd do is, like, I'd release, like, you know, a few flavors. Like, it would be a box. People could prepay, and then I would have a location, and they would come get it, and it was, like, low contact, and that was it.
Nice.
So I sold out very quick on my first one. It was Ashmont Grill in Dorchester under Chris Douglas, who's amazing.
How long into the pandemic was that first, like, pre-sell a bunch of stuff and everybody come get it?
That's September.
September?
Yeah.
And you said you were also doing the, like, made-to-order, where people would order, pay you through Venmo, and you would drop it off. Like, what? Like, get us into, like, the business model.
Mine was just, like, doing pop-ups. So I just had, like, a set menu.
Okay.
People could order. I was doing it, like, via email confirmation. I finally got, like, all set up on Square.
Yeah, so your process.
I kind of winged it the first few times. I've just had people confirm via, like, I would have my email. I'm like, email me, like, your order. I'll put it, like, on a, you know, paper, write down your order, and then we'll exchange via, I think it was Venmo I was doing at the time. And then I would go to a different, like, a location at a certain time, and people would have, like, a 2 to 3 hour pickup window.
Got it. And how much volume were you doing with that?
I mean, I started out very small. I think I did like 25 boxes the first day.
Okay. And how did that, over what time and what amount of growth did you experience?
I mean, it's funny. Like, as soon as I did that first pop-up, I had people being like, these are so good. When's your next pop-up? And I was like, I don't know. So that was like a shock to my system. And then I started to look at different places. People started to reach out to me. Like, I did a lot of, I had like a semi, it wasn't like a permanent pop-up space, but I was there for a long time, Bow Market in Somerville. So I was popping up there for a long time. So people could find me on the weekends there, which was cool.
Got it. Like, looking at your evolution as a pop-up, like, and just kind of going and just starting and not really knowing what to expect to, like, doing it long enough to where you, like, I think you stopped last year, right? You've been kind of,
I still do them occasionally. Okay. So.
But you were doing it almost full time for about a 3-year period, right?
Yeah.
So from when you first started to the evolution of it, like what were the micro changes, the efficiencies, the patterns, the clarity in what you offered? How did that distill over time?
Well, one of the biggest things I learned, as I said, like a recovering people pleaser, is saying no and also not going beyond my limits, because I'm always like, oh, I could do more. It's like there's only so much time in the day. Like, right. I can't. And like, I noticed there was a few pop-ups where like my quality suffered, and I like am so hard on myself, but just like disappointing. You don't want to disappoint people.
Yeah.
And I'm very good about it. I'd be like, refund people. I'm like, you know, if this really bothers you, they're like, no, I just want to give you feedback. I'm like, I understand that. But as me, I'm just like way too prideful. So that was always hard. So I eventually started to pull back and like only release so much. Like, I knew how much money I needed to make. So it's just like, you don't need to go crazy. You know, set the limits and right. have it be the limits. So like learning to say no has been like such an evolution for me.
Were you here when we were talking about that with Matt Berry and Vinny in Dante?
I think so, maybe.
So it's funny because the same thing. We're really focusing on pop-ups this week of the past two episodes, really. We've been getting a lot of requests from people to go deeper into pop-ups and the ins and outs. Because it's kind of like, for many people I get on the show, it's a part of their journey. But I feel like doing it today, it's like there's not a lot of full conversations dedicated
to
the
evolution of it. I feel like there's also like some, like with certain people, and I hate this, is like there's like weird gatekeeping too.
Why? Like keeping information?
Yeah, I think it's also
competition.
Like, it's also like, yeah, it's industry-wide. It's like I feel like a lot of people are now, like especially with like, you know, social media being the way it is, a lot of people are speaking up about like what they do. And I've had a lot of people approach me about like pop-ups and whatnot, like how I structure mine and whatnot. And I share that information. I'd rather, like, there's something for everybody.
Right, abundance mentality. And we all get better the more we all share.
Yeah, and I called it out because there's a donut shop around the corner from Beaumarket. And they start to send some of their employees over to get my product. So I start to call them by name. I'm like, oh, yeah, tell your boss I said hi. And they're like, what? And I'm like, this doesn't have to be weird. Like, you make donuts, I make donuts. We do two different things. There's people that love yours. There are people that love mine. Like, this is like, it doesn't need to be weird.
Yeah.
You know, and I hate, like, this is also a bigger conversation in the industry. I always tell, like, especially with, like, you know, clout chasers, award chasers, like, this whole idea of being the best. Like, what does that mean? And it's interesting. It's like, by who?
Well, I think this is a really hot topic. And I think the industry is a victim of media.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I'm trying to do with this podcast is to give the industry a voice again.
Yeah.
And to talk to people about the industry and the ins and outs of the industry and what it's really like. If I talk people out of opening restaurants, I've done my job.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I feel like it's the Thrillist. It's the Food and Wine. It's the James Beard Awards.
Yeah.
It's the Michelin Stars. It's the Food Network.
Yeah.
It's all these outside medias that come and they look, they have an outside looking in, and they're also trying to create a facade. Like, just like a restaurant's job is to create a facade for the guest. Everyone's focusing on the facade. No one's focusing on the reality of the industry. It's the sexiness. It's the glitz. It's the glamour.
Yeah.
And like, we all started chasing that because that's what we were told it's about.
Yeah. And I'm one of these people, like, I'm very outspoken on social media. I'm a little spicy sometimes.
I saw some comments about a knife being like, I think going back a year ago, there was like a colored knife, and that maybe it was somebody else who had words about that. Maybe it was somebody else.
Maybe. I don't know.
Never. Never mind.
I mean, I've said some pretty, I wouldn't say aggressive things, but I'm definitely, I speak my mind.
Like what?
I mean, I'm big in calling out people. I have no problem with that, especially these, you know, toxic boys in the Boston culture. I'm just like, I don't have time for this.
Yeah.
I'm very outspoken about that. I'm like, if you want to come for me, you can. And that's why I think it's funny, because a lot of people are afraid to go up against, like, if I wouldn't say they're like industry juggernauts, but I'm just like, no, I will go up against them. I will say these things. I'm like, if you want to come for me, I have, like, you know, 2 feet to stand on. I have evidence of your bullshit. Like, what are you going to do? And, you know, it's like, I try to empower other people with that. And I'm like, these people cause harm. Keep receipts. Like, right. I'm very much that person. Yeah. I'm the queen of the screenshot. I'm always like, is this you? And they're like, and I'm like, don't do that. Yeah. So,
well, it's good to have a voice, and I think that we have to open up and share perspective. And there is an old boys brigade out there, and there's from like a male perspective, is there security in like a sense of feeling like, you, if you're with the boys, you won't get in trouble,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Because like, what happens with the boys stays with the boys.
Yeah.
And but if we want to be more inclusive, if we want to have a place where everyone feels comfortable, like, yeah, we gotta kind of put some of that shit behind us.
Yeah. One of the funnier moments I had is one of my girlfriends. I love her dearly. Her partner was the wine director at that, you know, abusive restaurant in Yvonne's I worked at. And I still remember it was like one of the first industry events back at James Curley's. And she came up to me because, you know, I'm super outspoken online. I spoke out a lot during on the pandemic. And also me and Keith Saracen were behind Industry United on Facebook.
Okay.
Those we were the two people behind that. And it, you know, became the thing that was. And, you know, offered support to everybody in the industry. But she came up to me and she was like, you know, what you said, you know, you speaking about your trauma, like you're, you know, you've helped me get through a lot of hard stuff. And I just watched her partner at the time, the wine director, pull her away from me. And he said something of like, don't listen to her, like, don't give her like, you know, oxygen, like this, that, and the other thing. And I was like, yeah, because I'm telling the truth, because you're part of the boys club, that you benefit from this. And you just stay with the boys club because, you know, you're getting the high paychecks. You're having the lavish dinners. You can, you know, buy all the expensive wine you want. You know, it's like, yeah, it must be nice.
I mean, it's hard for me in full transparency because, I mean, I grew up in this industry. I had parents that had this industry. Like, I was 3 to 13 living in a restaurant, and I continued to work in restaurants throughout college. But I never got to the point, to the level you're at, where you rose to the top of the restaurants, where you're the executive pastry chef, where you're talking to the other executives and managers, and you're jockeying, and there's that like, I personally never made it into the boys club.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's hard for me to have a perspective.
Yeah.
And so like, I can only guess.
Yeah. And I'm also not saying like all men. It's just like, it's sad that these clusters still exist.
Yeah.
And it breaks my heart that even after the pandemic, where you thought we rattled a lot of these cages, and just watching people go back to that kind of mentality because it's familiar and it's comfortable. Mm-hmm. It's just gross.
Yeah, I hear you.
I mean, I have no fucking problem calling it out. We had it recently in Boston. It happened on Eater actively, where, you know, they're promoting Mr. Michael Scalfo, and the comment section was a bloodbath. Mm-hmm. Because this is a human who has never taken accountability for his actions and what he put his staff through. And, you know, I actually spoke out in an article about him against it too, because he needs to be held accountable.
Yeah. Do you think, has it ever gone to the point where, I mean, what would you call it? Like, it is, would you call this like reverse sexism? Is that like kind of like, or like reverse racism, where like the answer is to like overcompensate and like, point, I don't know, like I'm this is like wild wild west to me, obviously.
Yeah.
So like, how, like, I guess, has there ever been a point where like in order to make a correction, which I'm on board with,
yeah,
like there was a correction that it was needed, did we ever take it too far where there were some people that were like literally like hounds looking for opportunities?
Yes. So this is the bigger conversation I talk about. Like, it's especially, you know, since all of us were stewing at home on our phones during the pandemic, is cancel culture. It's such an interesting thing. And like, it's still like in its infancy, where people just don't understand, like, yes, people do bad things, but at what point, you know, like, what steps are we giving these people to be rehabilitated? Like, is there a point of no return? Like, what is off the table for, you know, getting someone active help? We've seen a lot in the industry where there's toxic people. We call these people out. It's like, are we helping them? Are we giving them, like, is that an option? Or I've seen these people do horrible things, and the big move I've seen is they disappear for a while, or they deactivate their comments on Instagram. They come back a few months later and they're like, oh, nothing happened. I'm like, you didn't do the work at all. So you think like people just forget? It's like, no. Absolutely not.
I hear that. And I think, but at the same time, looking at the people who are the guilty, right? Not making excuses for them, but I do think it's good to be holistic in the way we think about things. We're a byproduct of the world we came up in.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I look at my parents sometimes, and I think about some of their views. I love my parents. They're fantastic people.
Yeah.
But they're also a byproduct of the world they came up in.
Yeah.
And I think if for people in their 40s or 50s or 60s, the world is changing so fast.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying the way that they were or are is right, but I also do empathize with them to a degree, because they are only a byproduct of that world, or what they're doing. They're just monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah, of course. But also at the same time, you should, like, any human be willing to adapt?
Right.
And that's the biggest, because people get stuck in the ways.
Are giving people the chance? Yeah. Or are we just coming down and dropping the hammer on them and canceling them?
Yeah.
So I'm not saying what they're doing is right, but I do think that there is an incentive on the other side, the victim side.
Yeah.
And they are victims. I'm using that word just to be clear about which side I'm
talking about. Oh, yeah, for sure.
That it's almost become to this point where it's like, I want to pitch my wagon on this opportunity to get exposure on this subject because I can come up and use that as a slingshot to get my time in the light. Mm. This is very controversial. And I'm not...
Oh, no, I'm
like,
not...
And there are people who should be speaking up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, where how do we find the balance?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, when it comes to this kind of stuff, I always tell people, like, at least give the people the chance to justify what why they're doing these things. But half the time, they don't.
Right.
That's when I think you can get aggressive and be like, hey, like, don't do this.
Right, right. I think there needs to be change. I think change is happening. I don't think we give ourselves credit how much progress we've made in this.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of more sensitivity, as Matt Berry was bringing up, like mental health days and that kind of stuff. Yeah. Like, I'm glad people are taking that seriously. Because I still remember when I was talking about having panic attacks and like going to therapy, like it was so taboo at the time. It's like, oh, you're mentally ill. I'm like, everybody is a little fucked up. And like, I think everybody should go to therapy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely
for sure.
None.
Back to the business side of things.
Yeah, far track.
No, I love the sociopolitical. Like, our mission statement is to inspire, empower, and transform the industry. Yeah. And it's empowering them with like business knowledge.
Yeah.
But it's also... So it's the empowerment with the knowledge around how to run the business, but it's also the cultural side.
Yeah.
And like, that's really how we're going to transform things is talking about the reality, the culture of our industry.
Yeah. And this is why I always tell people, it's like, a lot of people know me because I make like really, I make good food and like fun things that I'm known for, but also people know it's because I'm a good fucking person and I stand up for stuff and I'm a huge advocate. Like, I never thought I'd be in this position because I don't know if you even remember me from high school, but I mean, I was quiet.
Oh, I remember you, and I remember that you were quiet.
Yeah. Like, I was the nerdy girl, and I got good grades, and I didn't really talk to anybody, and that has since stopped. And I can't shut up, but...
Great for a podcast.
Yeah, for sure. But I never thought I'd be in this position to be an advocate. I just feel so good that I'm able to, from my experiences, help so many people.
Yeah. And I want this platform to be a platform for people to share on, no matter what their perspective is. And I try to talk to people from all different walks so we can get that multiverse of perspective.
Yeah.
And I honestly think we're all living in the multiverse. I think the fact that you and I are the fourth dimension.
Yeah.
We're both looking at this camera. From my perspective, it's a completely different thing for you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, we are in the same time, we're experiencing that camera.
Yeah.
And it's two completely different things,
yeah,
depending on who are, what our values are, what our lens.
Yeah.
We all have these different perspectives and billions of perspectives in the world.
Yeah.
Like I want to get all of it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's super important. But back to the pop-ups and actually, like, what were your challenges getting started with the pop-up? So, I want you to know that, like, our audience is you in 2020.
Yeah.
Like, what do you know now that you wish you knew then? We're going to take a break to thank our sponsors, and we'll come right back to unpack that. This podcast is made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. Everyone who attends this live event will get a recording of the Restaurant Systems Pro 4-day How to Run a Profitable Restaurant from Soup to Nuts recording. This event costs $2,500 to attend live, and you'll get it for free. Head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. That's go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode made possible by Owner.com. Owner.com is the quickest and easiest way for your customers to order directly from you without the expensive 30% commission fees. Ugh. With Owner.com, you'll save thousands every month when customers order through your website and branded app instead of third-party delivery apps, and reward your customers with a built-in loyalty program that turns them into regulars who order again and again. Owner.com also helps you rank higher on Google with world-class search engine optimization built specifically for restaurants with an AI-powered website.
We cannot forget lists. Build a huge list of people who live near your restaurant fast and market to that list on autopilot with text and email sent at the perfect time to help you grow sales and stay top of mind. Owner.com gives you everything you need to grow and market your restaurant online with no contracts or hidden fees. Visit owner.com/unstoppable right now to book your free demo and see why thousands of restaurant owners trust owner.com to power their restaurants online. We're back.
So I don't know. I'm very thankful, like, what I learned along the way. As I said, like, setting boundaries was big, like, about what I could do for output. I was, during my first few pop-ups, I was working out of my house. Because, I mean, that's just how things were during the pandemic. And then eventually I went on to use different friends' kitchens. I ended up about to open up in a food hall at one point, High Street Place.
Yeah.
That was on the table for a while. I ended up pulling out last minute. Another thing, it's like I learned during that time that a lot of people think that a lot of decisions are black and white. Like there's one way or the other. I'm like, I'm taking the third option. And everybody's like, what's the third option?
Yeah. And for every scenario, there's a third option.
Yeah. And mine was,
there are no rules.
Yeah. And, at the time I had an extremely toxic business partner. I noticed this with a lot of people in the industry. It's very strange. A lot of people are ideas people. They don't have execution, just ideas. So I wouldn't have, taking the space if I knew what was going into it. Yeah. You know, I was a one-woman team, and there was just, like, not a lot communicated between my business partner and the leasing agent. I can only work an abbreviated schedule at the time because it was just me. And a lot of people don't understand with pastry that it's so prep-heavy.
Right.
It's not like I walk into a kitchen and I'm like, all right, I'm going to start cooking as soon as doors open. It's like, no, I need to have everything done.
Yeah.
So I'm there, like, 8 to 10 hours before, like, making all the product, and a lot of people don't realize that. So the schedule they wanted me to stick to would have been 7 days a week at the time, open the full hours, and I wouldn't have gotten any sleep. Like, I had a parking space in the building, but I would have slept an hour in my car. I'm like, I don't
want... This was a food court, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this was earlier on. So that, that opportunity came to you soon. Yeah. I mean, it's tough. And you're just jogging my memory, and I brought this up earlier. Matt was saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Where, like, when you first start, you got to say yes to everything.
Yeah.
But over time, once you get repetitions, and you take the mystery out of what is it going to be like.
Yeah.
And you start finding out what makes sense for me and my unique ability and my unique interests, my unique values and all these things. Like, what you start to say yes to everything, to be more selective with what you say yes to based off of the data you picked up.
Yeah.
And every two operations are different too. Like, to your point, baking is like a chemistry set you're bringing with you to all these different places.
Yeah.
And it's time and temperature and humidity, all these different variables that need to really kind of be fixed to get any kind of consistency. So get more into that.
Yeah, it's like a lot of people didn't realize what was going into that. And at this point, I was doing like 6 to 9 pop-ups a week. And that goes, a lot goes into it. I had one day off, and then the rest of the week was like planning menus, planning my schedule, like doing the shopping. I was going to Restaurant Depot all the time. I basically lived there. And then on the weekends, I was getting anywhere from 0 to 5 hours of sleep. It just wasn't like a healthy regimen. And then I go into this, you know, food court space, and my business partner wasn't helping me at all. I would like literally beg him for help. And he like, he like gave me funding, but I was just sitting there. I'm like, I actually need help. I'm not okay. I'm tired. I'm not taking care of myself.
Prior to this point, were you primarily going to commissary kitchens and from home, going cooking everything and then taking the finished product to sell? Was that
like I was cooking out of the stall. That was the cool part. Like, I had a full like donut fryer and everything, so I was there all the
time.
This
is at the
food court.
The food court.
So I had an agreement where I could.
Because you were working before that, weren't
you?
Oh,
yeah.
So was that like the order of operation is like cook everything under a controlled environment,
yeah,
bring the finished product for sale?
Oh, yeah.
Is that your approach?
Yeah, and I had like a little 2-door Honda Civic. I was schlepping everything out of that. It was...
I don't know how else you could do it because like Dahlia, for example, Matt Berry's pop-up, the fine dining, where he'd bring all the raw ingredients and then put everything together on site and plate.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't recommend doing that.
No, definitely not. Not for pastry.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's one thing I also learned after working in enough restaurants. Try to leave enough room for error. And by that, like for pastry stuff, especially when I do menu launches and whatnot, and menu flips, I make sure my stuff's done the day before.
Okay.
I'm never like a game time person. I don't like doing that same for events and everything. And that goes for like doing pop-ups.
To me, I like that approach of a pop-up. because you can just show up and focus on the people and the relationships and making human connections. You're not head down executing.
Yeah, you're not scrambling and like looking like a hot mess, even though I still managed to look like one, which is fine. So
you look great today.
Thank you.
So you said that this stall opportunity, how long from when you started Lionheart Confections to you moved to the stall? What was that period of time?
I want to say like 6 months.
6 months. Yeah. So like you started in September?
Yeah.
So we're now into 2021.
Yeah.
Fall of 2021. Or sorry, spring of 2021, winter of 2021.
Yeah.
And you have this partner.
Yeah.
And we're not going to mention names. I don't think you mentioned the name yet.
No, it didn't. He sucks.
So when you started talking, like what did that dialogue look like? Have you gone into partnerships since then? Do you know more about partnerships?
I know more about partnerships, and like I hate how jaded I am, where I'm very untrusting of people.
I have trust issues too.
And that's why I haven't like really pushed for a storefront. There's only very few people I trust. And you know, I'm still in talks with those people. So I'm still waiting for like the right opportunity to come if I want to, you know, do a solid space for Lionheart. But after this partnership, I just saw like so many people just only care about themselves. And it was another situation where, you know, they're actively seeing me struggle and they're not extending the hand. It's just like, dude, like you're gonna be part of this. I'm making you money. You're trying to ride on my coattails. Like,
so what did that partnership in your mind, what did it look like? Was like this person going to be in it with you every day, working, like making pastries with you?
No, they were just supposed to help me with like the front end of stuff, as far as like, I've never done bookkeeping before.
Okay.
And I needed help with that. And like all the things that go into like running a space and like a restaurant, like the overhead and like, you know, being conscious of your utilities. And like, I need to make sure I have a company that can take the dirty oil. And those are the things I never thought of.
Right.
You know, and like, he's done that. He owned a restaurant. He owned a coffee shop I worked out of.
So who approached you and said, let's partner?
He approached me.
And what was the sales pitch to you?
I was doing a pop-up out of Dead Horse Hill in Worcester. My friend Jared owns it. He's another person you should talk to. He's wonderful. Him and his wife.
Nice.
And he came up to me. He's just like, I have an opportunity. I think you should take it. And he kept sending me pictures of like the stall. And he's like, you should do this.
So he was trying to sell you on the food space. And where is this food space, the food court?
It's in downtown.
Downtown
Boston. Like a financial district.
Got it. Initially, what were your concerns about that food space?
Just like the size, for one, it was like 300 square feet. Just like what we could do out of it. Because as much as I like, you know, doing the donuts, I also didn't want to pigeonhole myself.
Right.
Because I understand that like a lot of, you're seeing a lot of these places that do just one thing. We've seen a lot of in the pastry world die. Like, I think everybody remembers Crumbs Bakery, the cupcake shop.
Right.
They had I can't remember how many freaking locations they had in New York City. And I think all of them are closed now.
Wow.
Like oversaturation of the market, and same thing like is coming with donuts. Like there's many donut shops.
Scaling too fast and trying to think that you capture magic in a bottle, but scaling magic is hard to do.
Yeah,
and I think when you try to go too fast, whatever it was, the magic dilutes. Jeremy just walked in. What's up, my man? Thank you for letting us use your space.
Hi.
Hey guys.
Love
awesome.
You.
What's going on?
Well, it's good to see you.
Good to see you.
There's Choco Tacos downstairs.
So back along that train of thought, Jeremy, the co-owner of Industries, just walked in. Also co-owner of Stash Box.
Yeah.
Awesome guy. Nod to Industry East and Stash Box, Manchester, New Hampshire, for letting us use their space.
Yeah.
Keep going if you remember what you were saying. So I kind of forgot. I'm not going to lie. So you're talking about moving into the new space.
Yeah.
You didn't want to pigeonhole for no
Yeah, it's like I wanted, and the thing is, I was having reluctance about it because I wanted to be able to do like cakes and ice cream and stuff, and I was so limited to the space. But the thing is, like, I needed more funding at that point, and like trying to find that was like hard. Like, I invested $10,000 on my own into that space. I don't regret it at all because I got to use the space essentially for free. So I kind of equated to like that's what I would have paid rent for. And then my business partner, you know, fleshed out, but we needed more funding to build out stuff because I wanted to be able to have an oven there. I want to be able to hold this, and there's just so many roadblocks because it's a food hall, because you had to abide by certain standards there, and like there's no crossover with product, you know, between the different vendors. It was just annoying.
Food hall politics.
It was annoying. So flash forward to, you know, I'm having anxiety. And also the events manager there was garbage. Like, she was two-faced. Like, she would be like, oh, chef, this chef, like, talking to me that way. And then she would, like, throw me under the bus for stuff she did. I was like, I'm going to kick you in the teeth. And she eventually got fired, ex-prized. But that, just, like, all these little things were pointed to, like, I just don't want to do this. I don't think I want to do this.
How long were you doing that before you made, from when you...
About a year.
About a year. So you were at this location for a year.
Yeah, so we get to the following year when we finally get a slated open date. And we have our first operators meeting. It's like every single person from all the stalls. And I remember we were all sitting there. And by the end of the meeting, I had, you know, my business partner next to me. And I'm like, I don't think I can do this.
What made you think that?
Because we got the packet and it said like the hours. Mm. And they tried to have all vendors initially be open the full hours. And some days were 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. And I'm like, I physically can't do that.
6 days a week? 7 days a week?
6 days. Six days a week. Okay. And I'm just like, this is impossible. I don't.
11 to when?
7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
7 to 11. Got it.
So it's just like utterly insane. And I looked at my business partner. I'm like, I can't physically do this. And he literally looked me in the face and goes, I don't think you want this bad enough. And I was like, how dare you?
Right.
So I come back the next day and I was like, you know what? I don't. I'm done. And he's like, what? And I'm like, I'm done. And he's like, he was trying to tell me I needed to fall on the sword for like, I think he was trying to hold me for like 50K for the space, but there was some discrepancies in the paperwork. I made sure to get a lawyer. Make sure I always have
the best piece of advice right there.
Yeah. Always have a lawyer.
Even if
always
you don't have the money, find a way to get a lawyer.
A lot of lawyers will look over stuff for you. So I had that, and I made sure that I had an out clause in my...
Did they add that, or was that their advice, or did you say, I want to make sure to have an out clause?
They made sure I did.
Okay.
Within the first 6 months, if something felt bad, I could leave no harm, no foul. And I told them this when we were signing paperwork. I said, hey, you know, there's some, amendments to this. And they go, yeah, yeah. I'm like, you should probably read it. And they're like, yeah, and they signed it. So as soon as, like, my business partner tried to be like, oh, well, you're accountable for 50K, I'm like, no, I'm not. Read the paperwork. You guys signed it. So it was like the mic drop, and I was like, yeah, I can't do this.
Well, I think it's important to kind of get into the details of why you said it was going to be 7 to 11, 6 days a week. That in itself, yeah. How many hours a week is that? 7 to 7 would be 12 plus another
5
on top of that. So you're looking at 16 hours a week per day?
Yeah, but that's open.
That's open, and then you have to get – this is what I'm trying to lead you into.
All the prep hours, yeah. So.
So what time would you have to get there?
I'd probably have to get there at midnight.
Right. So you'd literally be getting like what? Like 4 hours of personal time a day?
Yeah.
To like rest and recover? And
maybe.
Right.
If that.
Unless you had a business partner, which you thought you did.
Yeah.
And he wasn't there.
No.
So did you ever open in that space or did you walk away?
I walked away. And in hindsight, it was one of the hardest things for me because a lot of people... As I said, I'm way too hard on myself, and I thought everybody hated me, this and the other thing. I thought the GM of the space hated me. Her and I have since had words, and she didn't realize all the shit I was going through between my business partner and the leasing agent. I was, of course, vilified because I'm a woman, and I stood my ground, and I made sure to have my ass covered, and, you know, they got caught. And so walking away from that space was hard, but also, once again, there was chatter in the industry. I still remember hearing from my mutual friend who owns a restaurant in Quincy that we have a mutual, this girl runs her mouth and she was telling everybody what a failure I was. Like, this is the only opportunity I had to like really make something of myself. Like, how dare I? Like, you screwed up. So once again, I am very outspoken. Of course, my friend's like, don't say anything to her. I don't want to deal with the drama. I was in the middle of the bar. I called her and I literally told her, I said, you need to keep my name out of your mouth. Like, I don't have time for this. Oh, I don't know. I'm like, I know what you're talking about. I'm like, if I hear that one more time from anybody, this is going to be a problem.
Yeah.
So it's just like those kind of things. And you just feel like it sucks. Like, you know, people say these things behind your back, but it's like, no, I did the right thing. Because in hindsight, that stall is empty. Because wow. Blackbird took over the space for me and they were there for about a year.
For the whole, the unit still there? The actual food hall?
The food hall's still there. Just like any of these food halls, a lot of people don't realize. And that's also another thing that, as I said, I'm the ADHD part of my brain is like the more information, the better. I knew the reality of the situation because it's still the financial district of Boston. But what a lot of people didn't take into accountability was a lot of people are remote now. Mm. So a lot of that business they were like banking on, like it wasn't there.
Yeah, it evaporated.
Right? Yeah. So I'd always ask the percentages. I'm like, what's the occupancy percentage right now. And it's, it was like, I think under, I think it was like 18% when I was there. I'm like, that's not enough for people to come in here all the time and spend money.
Yeah. I would be curious to know, like, I'm kind of, the food hall was a big thing, like, over the past, like, 5 years.
Yeah, like, timeout market, like, that kind of stuff. They're huge, and giving people all the options and stuff.
I don't know if they work everywhere.
I don't think so. Major cities, but even then, we're seeing, like, I want to say the big one in L.A. is closing, I think, I heard. But it's just utterly insane to watch.
And it's only getting the food delivery. By delivery, I mean all the ways we can move food.
Yeah.
Whether it be a full service restaurant or a fast casual or a quick service, or now we have delivery ghost kitchen only. Like, we have pop ups, we have food courts. Like, there's so many vehicles. Like, it's fragmenting.
Yeah.
And there's only so many people who are looking to eat.
Yeah.
Now you have, there's also meal kits. Delivered meal, like meal, like plant, like where you'd have, like, it's already made and you're just heating it up.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many different ways to get food today, where before it was like the grocery store or a full service restaurant.
Yeah.
And that wasn't that long ago.
No.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's crazy. So since that experience, when you pulled out of the food hall.
Yeah.
That was 2021.
Yeah. Yeah.
What? Like, you had 2 more years of working on Lionheart thereafter.
Yeah.
Because you took a break about a year ago.
Yeah.
So what was the next two years like?
Basically kind of just seeing what I wanted to do with Lionheart. As I said, I was really hard on myself. I was feeling like a failure. As I said, imposter syndrome, all those things. I took a step back. I ended up going into consulting for a little while at that point.
What were you consulting on?
A restaurant on the South Shore. It was like an Asian influence concept.
Full service restaurant?
Yes.
Got it.
So I was consulting and eventually came on as the pastry chef. That restaurant has since closed just because of poor management. I will not mention names. It was one of those situations where you could tell the owner, like, what was going wrong, and they just wouldn't listen. Basically, the restaurant was getting treated like it was their living room.
Okay.
And people just don't understand, like, comp tabs and stuff. I'm like, that money has to come from somewhere.
Right.
So all their friends were, racking up these tabs and getting, one of their partners was always eating these lavish meals and stuff, and like, it was all getting comped, and I'm just like, you are eating your bottom line. Like, we are not even open. We're not in the green. Like, as a lot of people know, like, a lot of restaurants will tell you, like, within the first 2 years, that's when ideally you start turning a profit. But I mean, we were barely open a few months.
Right.
And just watching that happen, like, I think I was there from February till November, and the comp tab was up to $100,000.
Wow.
It was utterly insane.
Wow.
But one of the best things I got out of that is the executive chef, Brad, is one of my best friends. Like, so I am thankful for that experience. So I was still doing pop-ups then while still doing dessert menus. It was one of those things. I still love doing plated desserts and having that, expression. So I was able to find love in my pop-ups again when I was doing them, and I wasn't doing them all the time.
Yeah. Any other just like things that haven't come out in terms of your advice for somebody who's interested in doing what you've done in terms of specifically baked good pop-ups?
Yeah.
That could come out before we start talking about where you're headed, the future of the industry, and we start to wrap up.
Okay. Like, any advice?
Yeah, like anything that hasn't come out for your unique situation. Because I feel like the world of pop-ups can be so, every scenario is unique, but bakery is, I feel like, a unique beast. Your whole approach to doing a pop-up is commissary, cook, bring to, sell.
Yeah.
How to promote that, how to brand that, like anything you got for us.
Trying to think, it's like, it's so much. Don't be afraid to fall on your face. I'm one of the things, I've gotten more brazen in my older age where I'm just like, I'm just gonna do it.
And you were profitable, right?
Yes.
Like, any advice on like how to make sure it's profitable?
Like, one of the things I am, like, make sure you're designing menus not out of ego. Make sure that you're giving people what they want, but also making sure your bottom line is good.
Okay.
That was always big. I always, like, when I was doing, like, back-to-back weeks of pop-ups and stuff, making sure ingredients are rolling or making sure I'm using everything, being conscious of that kind of things. Like, if I make a crumble or something, I can use that crumble next week, but, like, dress it up in a different flavor and, like, having that, being smart about those kind of things.
What's on the horizon for you? What's your dream today?
So I'm in a very precarious spot right now. I went through a lot in the past year. I went from, I give you the cliff notes when I saw you, where it was like, I got engaged, I got in a major car accident, I injured my hand pretty bad where I couldn't do pastry for 4 months. I ended up taking a restaurant job where I was just serving, which drove me nuts because the general public. And then once I was healed, I was back to doing pop-ups. But then I went back to a restaurant job to recover from all of that, only for that restaurant to close. So that was, it's been like such an experience dealing with all that. I ended up taking a job at a music venue, which I still work at, which is one of the best things I've ever done for my mental health. And then I ended my engagement by the end of the year because my partner cheated on me. So
yeah.
Right now my focus is just getting back to myself and finding that love in what I do. So I am starting a new restaurant job, next week, actually, in the mornings. And like Lionheart's not dead yet. I'm just waiting for the right opportunity because I've had a lot of people approach me about different opportunities. And of course, like, you know, getting a storefront, but I just want to do it when it feels right.
So you've gotten a lot of reps in with Lionheart, yeah. And you've gotten that clarity and you're saying you just want to do you. Well, who is Kate Halicek as far as if you were to manifest yourself in a business tomorrow?
Yeah.
What does that look like? What's your dream? Like, what's that perfect case scenario?
I just remember where I have a lot of creative freedom is definitely like what brings me joy. That's why I like, you know, the job I'm taking. It's like they gave me carte blanche to do whatever I want. So it's going to be like an upscale steakhouse on the North Shore. And I'm like, I'm going to be able to do the steakhouse classics, but make them mine. And by that, I use fun ingredients, very whimsical takes on things. I always like a lot of my desserts lie the nostalgic. You know, I try not, because I always tell people when it comes to pastry, when stuff is super fussy, like they wonder why these desserts don't sell. I'm like, yeah, because it's all about your ego. Mm. These like pretty little plates and foams and all these weird ingredients. And people look at the dessert menu and they're like, I don't know what the hell this is.
So
I'm not going to order.
What does sell?
You know, of course, the nostalgic chocolate always sells.
Savory. We were talking about the salts before.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do a lot of savory takes on stuff. I always, that's another thing is, I don't make my desserts super sticky sweet. That's always like a hallmark.
Your cookies are delicious.
Thank you.
I got some cookies last week. They did not make it home.
No. I'm all about just having that balance.
Yeah.
Because it's nothing more irritating when I tell people what I do for a living and they go, well, I don't like sweets. I'm like, that's great. I didn't ask you. Like, yeah. I'm literally telling you what I do for work. But it's all about balance. Yeah. So.
Do you want to have a brick and mortar? Is that an aspiration of yours? Or
it's one of those things now. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like it's still, I'm leaving it open because that's where I'm kind of leaving my life open right now. I'm like, I don't know what's on the horizon for me, you know? It's just been a difficult time of like healing and doing the active work. I've been really digging deep into myself and doing the active therapy because, you know, I just got ran over last year. So I'm just trying to get back to myself and like heal myself and then go from there.
Yeah. So you're really just trying to put Kate first.
Yeah, for once, because I haven't in a long time.
And I think you know, it's important. I think we put a lot of pressure on young people to make big life decisions.
Yeah.
And like, you're 18 years old. What do you want to do for the rest of your life?
Yeah. And the different conversation, like, I know it's like on our, like anybody, but on women especially, it's like there's always a ticking clock. Like, you know, I'm pushing 40 now. Like, I'm going to be 39 this year. And, you know, it's like, oh, my God, well, you're not married and you don't have kids. I'm like, well, I can't physically have kids. And I, you know, my situation happened. But I also don't want my relationship to define me. That's always been, you know, irritating. So there's just always just the added societal pressure. But understanding now, it's just like, I'm going to do stuff at my own pace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good for you. So like paint, I mean, you started to kind of paint that picture of what that looks like.
Yeah.
And continue to like make some brushstrokes as to like what that dream scenario, because I think you are a great representation of a lot of people.
Yeah.
In the industry, you know, who don't necessarily have a voice and painting the new normal of our industry. Like, what does that look like?
And this is a callback to what you discussed with Matt is quality of life. Mm. I realize how important that is. Like, I tell people, like, the second half of my year last year was like my eat, pray, love, and I'm still like doing that. Where I'm saying yes to more fun experiences and, you know, making time for myself and going to those concerts and putting myself first and like, I'm gonna travel, I'm gonna, you know, making these priorities instead of being like, well, maybe they need me at work that day.
Right.
Like, that's the big thing, prioritizing my mental health, saying no, even if it upsets people.
Right. What has to happen on a greater cultural scale in order for restaurants and restaurant people to live the way we should live to have that balance? Because right now, I feel like the societal expectations on restaurants in terms of like price point, in terms of availability, they're like, oh, they're not open, or oh, that costs how much.
Yeah.
In order for us to obtain basic human, I don't know, you know, quality of life, it's almost unrealistic to ask what's needed from the consumer to make that happen.
Yeah.
You see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on, like, continue that train of thought. Like, how do we live in an ecosystem that enables us to have that quality of life?
I think we're still trying to get to it. That's the thing. It's like, we're in a very precarious spot in the industry right now where we're seeing, like, we saw a lot of restaurants close in Boston. We're seeing a whole nother wave of them close. Like, the people that were holding on by their fingernails, like, those places are starting to fall. So it's, I don't know if I really have an answer to that, because, like, things are drastically changing. You know, price points are going up. You know, wages are going up. So we have to raise menu prices. And a lot now, since the pandemic, a lot of people are not going out.
Right.
They're not going out. They're not spending the money they used to. It's just, it's been interesting to navigate. And that's right. Another reluctance why I haven't opened a place. It's just because just kind of waiting this wave out. Because I just don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Have you ever thought about classes or making more of an experience-based? Or is that too much for your...
I actually said this to someone the other day. I hate teaching.
Yeah. It's not for everybody.
No, it's like, I like when it's like in a controlled environment where it's like an RA space, like, set up for cooking.
Or if you care about the person you're teaching, but not some stranger.
Not even that. It's just like, people don't realize when it comes to classes and stuff, like, there's so much that goes into it. Like, I can give people the recipes, but it's like, am I purchasing the ingredients? Are they purchasing the ingredients? Are these going to be, like, there's just so much to go into it. And right. Also just like understanding, like, what the price point should be. What will people pay? I always tell people, like, I hate when people come to my pop-ups and they try to tell me, like, you should sell your donuts for $7 a piece. They're amazing. I'm like, yeah, but there's a certain price point that people see and they will not purchase stuff because of that. Like, no matter how good something is, you have to still make it approachable for the guest.
Right. I mean, it's weird, but if it's good enough and if you are truly the best at it,
yeah,
right, you have that fan, like, people will pay a lot of money.
Oh, for sure. And I still make all my costs and stuff are covered, right. And I'm still making a profit, but I'm also not looking to rip off the guest. I want people to not have this be like a special occasion thing. I want them to come back every time I do a
pop-up. I don't know if there is a right answer. I think it's whatever, charge whatever you need to charge to be able to show up.
Yeah.
And if that is too much.
Yeah.
If for you to show up is going to be $30 for a donut, then maybe you don't want to do this.
Yeah, maybe it's a reevaluation at that point.
But if you think you're worth it and people are paying for it, then charge fucking $30 for a donut. If you found out a way to make that donut so unique that only you can do it.
Oh, yeah.
And people want to pay for it, don't be ashamed of charging
$30. Oh, no, I charge accordingly, and I definitely, like, you know, make sure I do. That's the one thing I'm actually happy about social media. Like, if something's hyped, people will pay whatever to get it.
Right.
They want to take the picture. They want to break it open and do all the reels and stuff. So it's like, people will pay.
And there's things to do. Like, you can pre-sell.
Yeah.
You know, like, get exactly, like, and hit your, if you know you can only do 300 donuts in a given amount of time.
Oh, yeah, that's what I do, yeah.
Then sell out of donuts and then, sorry, all sold out.
Oh, that's
then,
what I love. Scarcity mentality.
Hey, guess what? There's demand.
Yeah. And that's what a lot of my pop-ups survived on, was the scarcity mentality. Like, I sell out when I sell out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything we haven't discussed that you want to get out today? It's crazy. It's already been an hour and a half. It goes by so fast.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. No, it's like, I feel like we touched on all the topics. Like, as much as I love talking about my career, my passion for food, I definitely love talking about advocacy in the industry. Like, that's such a passion of mine. And I just want people to be armed with the tools to know that they can work in an environment and feel good.
Yeah. Knowing what you know now, do you think pop-ups are the way to go if you're trying to start a restaurant?
For sure. It's lower risk.
Yeah. What are the things that aren't discussed enough with pop-ups in terms of things that people should know?
How much goes into them, honestly? Like, just the utter ignorance. I'm not saying that meanly either. I was approached by a brewery recently that wanted me to be like a permanent donut pop-up, and just like the bewilderment of the ownership was actually kind of funny to watch. I didn't realize, like, you need this for a kitchen and this storage space. I'm like, I know, that's why I'm telling you. Yeah. Like, it's just funny. It's like, I just didn't realize. I'm like, yeah, a lot goes into it.
Right. I think you definitely, bakery is not the easiest to pull
off. No.
For sure. There's a lot of moving parts. Like,
especially with what I do, it's like, I need somewhere I can fry, and that means I need someone somewhere with like a hood system.
Right.
And then I need to be able to have cold storage and like be able to put my dough somewhere and like have an oven where I can cook crumbles and those kind of things. And like, so many people just don't realize this.
Have you ever thought about a gas station pop-up? Like, doing like a collab with a gas station?
Potentially. I know that's like big in other parts of the country. I just don't know if it's like big around here or if that's even an option.
There might be options.
There's options. There's
opportunity there. I think donuts pair perfectly with a gas station.
I mean, you see Dunkin' Donuts everywhere.
Yeah, and there's so many empty food stalls in gas stations across the country because, like, I don't know. I think it's an opportunity.
Yeah, but also at the same time, it's like I like having the flexibility of my life right now. So it's like do I want to be tied to a place anymore? It's like it's just a bigger conversation for myself down the line.
Yeah. Awesome. I've really enjoyed today's conversation.
Me too.
On a professional level and a personal level. Mm. Somebody I graduated high school with.
So it's strange. Kind
of fun to get you on the show.
I'm a real really person.
Yeah. And you were great. Thank you so much. A couple more questions before we say goodbye. So our mission statement. Actually, let me ask you this. What is something truly unstoppable about Lionheart Confections that we can recreate? Whether it be a way you did something, a quality, a value. What is that?
Like, what do you mean by that?
Something that, you know, like a restaurant unstoppable. Like, what makes you, Kate, unstoppable or Lionheart Confections unstoppable? Because you're still going. You haven't stopped.
I always tell people one of my hallmarks is like, and it's good to hear and it's hard to hear at the same time from my peers and my friends and family. It's like, you've been through so much in your life, but you still keep going. You still get up. And I always tell people, I think it's like the Leo in me or like, you know, my upbringing, but it's just like, I just have such fight. Like I'm not always down for the count. Even when stuff gets really, really bad, I still get up. I still fight.
Yeah. Yeah. And you bring treats, which makes making friends and having that support group 10 times better.
Yeah. But also at the same time, like, this is kind of like where my ego comes in. It's like, I have to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, you know, if I don't, who is, who's going to step up to the plate? Who's going to talk about these big things? Who's going to, you know, put themselves in these spaces and, like, you know, I'll put myself in front of so many people to protect people. Like, who's going to do that if I don't do it? So that's what keeps me going a lot. So,
right. I love that. Awesome. I'm thank you for getting those messages out because I don't have the experience and the perspective to be an advocate for those things.
Yeah.
So thank you. So the mission statement is to change the world through inspiring, empowering, and transforming the industry. And I think we're going to do that one person at a time, but how have you personally transformed? Who are you today versus the woman you were when you got started in this industry? I have thoughts, but I'll let you go.
Okay. I'm just stronger. I'm very, like, I stand behind what I say. I'm not as fearful anymore. Like, I mean, I still have moments where I get anxiety and I'm just like, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But it's like, no, I stand behind what I do. And even it's like, you know, and that includes, like, you know, I've had some major screw-ups in my career and, like, people I've let down and stuff. And people have their opinions of me. Like, I understand I'm not for everybody. I understand I'm polarizing to some people. I always tell people, you like me or you hate me. That's how you know me. It's not like, oh, she's like, everybody loves me. It's like, no, I know plenty of people that hate me, but that's fine. But I'm fine to be in those spaces.
Well, you have your standards. You have your values. Yeah. And you're not willing to sacrifice. And I think that's why we have values. Not everybody is going to love everybody.
No.
And I think it's important that, like, we are clear with our values and what we want to create so we can attract those who are like us to go further. I think there's almost like this, like, mission right now to make every... For a while, it was like this is what professionalism is.
Yeah.
Right? And I get professionalism, but also at the same time, we're all a little weird. You know,
like,
we're not all going to fit into that box of what's considered professionalism.
Yeah. And that's where I teeter the line where I live very authentically and genuinely.
Yeah.
And that throws a lot of people off because it's like these professional spaces, like, you know, oh, it's like you had this horrible employer. The number of times people will tell you in public spaces, like, oh, just be civil with them.
Right.
I'm like, now I'm just like, I don't owe you anything.
Right.
Don't fucking talk to me. I'm not going to be nice to you because of what you put me and others through. I don't owe you anything.
Yeah.
And some people are like, oh, that's so taboo. That's so spicy. I'm like, no, it's a boundary.
Yeah.
I don't need to be nice to these people.
Right. But I do want to see and recognize you for your transformation, for your willingness to stand by your values and what matters to you and not sacrifice. And I think that's the transformation I've seen. From quiet Kate, who's just going to take whatever's given to her to, like, no, this is what I want. Mm. This is what I like. This is what I'm good at. This is Kate.
Yeah.
And I'm standing by myself.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's awesome. Mm. So the last question, you ready for it?
Sure.
If you got the news, you'd be leaving this world tomorrow.
Yeah.
All the memories of you, your work, and your pop-ups would be lost with your departure, with the exception of three pieces of wisdom that you could leave behind for the good of humanity and your legacy. Mm. What would those three pieces of wisdom be?
I mean, the first is, as I said, like, earlier on, is, like, just have good intentions.
One.
that's like the biggest thing. Like, you know, even when I was in that toxic, you know, work situation with that culinary director, even when he was screaming at me, I still remember during a fight, he goes, yeah, but you're such a fucking good person. It's so annoying. And I'm just like, yes, and you're not. And that's what I always say. As much as I'm polarizing, as much as, you know, people have their opinions about me, they still cannot say I'm a bad person.
I love that. What's number two?
Man.
Dan's still here. We're still going. There's a dog. We're just wrapping up.
I like always be the student.
You're good, man. Don't worry about it. All right. We're wrapping up.
All right. Always just understand that you're always a student. Like I, as I said, like back to the conversation of the best, like that, I'm like, you know, it's so funny when people are like, oh, I look up to you, or like, you know, you're an expert. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm far from it. But that's why, you know, I'm always pushing myself and, you know, arming myself with information. I'm buying cookbooks. I'm, you know, keeping up on trends. And, you know, as I'm getting older, like, yes, I'm looking on TikTok and all these, you know, things and seeing how people are marketing stuff and how that can apply to Lionheart and like my brand. And, you know, just to understand you're always evolving. You're forever the student.
Was that three or still two?
Two.
Okay, it was three. Sorry. Distractions.
So those. And then I'm trying to think like other. I guess like trust your intuition, like trust your gut. Yeah. That has got me so far. And the number of times my gut has not steered me wrong is insane. I look back, I'm like, holy crap, how did I know that? Like, yeah. It was just very strange. But trust your gut, especially when it comes to these situations. Like, yeah, as I said, with advocacy, like if something feels wrong, it probably is.
Yeah. Who do you respect and admire? Somebody that if I were to go on the show, you'd absolutely tune in. Somebody who's got the right culture, who's fiscally responsible, who, you know, has the opportunity to scale and they're growing something special. Who is that person for you?
Trying to think. Like the Boston area, I mean, I adore Ken Oranger so much.
I'd love to get Ken.
He's
one
of my, like, he's another Boston dad. I just love him so much. And he's just leads with such a kind heart. He's opening up a gluten-free bakery with one of my best friends, Monica Glass, who another one you should get on the show. She is wildly talented. She opened up the whole conversation about gluten-free options and like making things taste good. Nice. And textually speaking, like she's absolutely
huge opportunities in that vertical.
She's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. I love Ken. He just like, you see like his restaurants and stuff and people stay there and that's like a hallmark. It's like, oh, because he brings them up. He gives arms them with tools and education, and he cares.
I mean, Jamie Bissonnette's been a two-time guest on the show, and the things he said about Ken are huge. So I'd love, Ken, if you're listening, man, I'd love to make it happen. Anybody else?
I love Jamie, too. Jamie's like a big brother to me.
Yeah, he's awesome.
It was interesting when I first came from New Hampshire to Boston. I was like the little kid that wanted to play with everybody. And I still remember it was the days of Twitter culture. So I start to engage in these like Boston foodie conversations. And I'm just like, hey, and everybody's like, who's this girl? Like, and I was just like, I just want to be friends with everybody. And so I met Ken and Jamie at Star Chef Congress in New York City when that was still a thing, the big chef conference. And they were like doing like, it was during like a food hour. So they were doing like a tasting. It was like, I can't remember what he did, like a tripe. Something with tripe. I had tripe for the first time. It was delicious.
My dad just made tripe last weekend. I don't know. Tripe texture. It's a texture thing.
It was really good when they did it. So I was talking to Ken, and I was just like the little fangirl. I'm like, I know you own a bunch of you know restaurants in Boston. Blah, blah, blah. Like, same thing with Jamie. And then Jamie kind of took me under his wing, and he's always just been a big brother to me. He's protected me in a lot of situations.
They're great
and
people.
Sure. I'm trying to think of anybody else in the Boston scene.
Well, you know me. You got my number. You can always let me know for sure. And how can we connect with you if we've enjoyed today's conversation? Maybe we want to collaborate with you or provide a pop-up space for you. Or maybe we're looking for a killer pastry chef.
Yeah, I always tell people I'm most active on Instagram.
Yeah.
I have my personal Instagram. It's at K Holochik, my last name, Holochik. I'm a Ukrainian broad. And Lionheart Confections.
Awesome.
So.
Kate, thank you so much for taking the time to reconnect with me, to share your story, to go deep into the world of pop-ups, and to get vulnerable and to open up about more than just cooking and business, but the socio-political issues surrounding our industry as well.
Of course.
There is no questioning. You are unstoppable. Mm. Cheers.
Thank you.
There's another episode wrapped up here at Restaurant Unstoppable. Special thanks to our guest today, Kate Holochik, for coming on and diving deep into the world of pop-ups and just your career as a pastry chef. It was really interesting perspective. Thank you so much. And the world of pop-ups is interesting. I can't go to somebody who's got an empire of restaurants 10, 20 years ago when they started and ask them about, you know, how they got to where they are today and to get great advice about pop-ups, because it's relatively a new approach and it's what I'm doing if I'm opening a restaurant tomorrow. And we've been getting a lot of requests to get people who are having success with pop-ups to come on the show, and it's a new starting point. So tons of interesting perspective around this. We're going to be hosting a pop-up panel. We're not dead set on a date yet. We had Matt Berry and Dante and Vinny Marino on the episode before this. We've had people like Rachel Miller with Nightshade Noodle on, and I have a pretty good network. Jarrett with Little Bear. I'm actually going to hopefully be running into him next week when I'm in Atlanta. We want to put together a panel for you guys. So stay tuned. If you're interested in a pop-up as a starting point, be sure to join Unstoppable Restaurant Owners and Operators to be up to date with when that's going to happen. We actually have a live Restaurant Unstoppable Network event happening Monday, today, as you're listening to this. If you're catching it early, 12 p.m. Mountain Time, 2 p.m. Eastern, that'll be 11 a.m. Pacific. We have a Q&A session with Alan Fratti and Danny Azzarello, the dudes behind Cracked Kitchen. So if you enjoyed that episode, be sure to check out the Q&A and join us live to meet Danny and Alan and ask your own questions. That's going to be happening March 25th today as this is going live at 12 p.m. Mountain, 2 p.m. Eastern. I would love to meet you. And then next week, we have a Q&A session with David Lombardo, the president and CEO of Lombardo Hospitality. That would be a great one if you're looking to do more catering and events. That's where he and his family have made their fortune and their career. And what else? I am literally on the road right now. I'm literally about to take off and head on the road. I'm headed to Atlanta, and I'm going to make my way through the Carolinas. If you're in those areas, actually, I'll probably already be I'll be in Carolina as you're hearing this. So reach out to me if you have a place for me to park my RV. I'm headed to Atlanta. Then I'll be driving through Birmingham, Alabama, Mississippi, making my way through Louisiana, Texas. And then I'm headed to Arizona, where I'm going to be spending some time there with Restaurant Systems Pro. And then I'm to the West Coast, Southern California, working my way north. So please reach out to me, eric@restaurantstoppable.com, if you have a crash pad for me, looking for a place to get some shore power and maybe fill up my water tanks. Any support on the road would be hugely appreciated. And this is actually freaking happening. I'm stoked. Thank you all for your support and helping me get here. This is going to be a game changer for Restaurant Unstoppable. Special thanks to Jared Parisi with his, just, you know, his loyalty sticking with me over these years through the peaks and valleys. Super fortunate to have you in my corner, Jared, and super psyched to have Callum Miola joining us, our community manager. The future's bright. We're just getting started. That's it for today. Until next time, peace out.